Welcome to the Hirschfeld Century Podcast. I'm Catherine Eastman, the Archives Manager of the Al Hirschfeld Foundation, and with me, as always,
David Leopold, the Creative Director.
His whole life. Well, not Creative Director, his whole life. But no. David Leopold, when people ask your name, you say David Leopold, or they say, are you David Leopold? And you say, my whole life.
That's true. That is true. Although I have a number of aliases, too.
Yes, and a twin brother.
Yes.
That I think, which is why I think you say that.
Yes. But I am David Leopold, and I am the creative director of the Al Hirschfeld Foundation. And what are we going to talk about today?
Today we are, actually, I don't think we've ever done this before in quite this way. We are going to focus on a single year in the Hirschfeld century, 1964, 60 years ago now.
Exactly. And it turns out to be a pretty interesting year.
It's a big year, too. There's a lot of important shows. Especially in theater and different things Hirschfeld does that you might not know about, different little side projects that we're also going to touch on.
Things that got started around this time, things that he did, things that he drew. This isn't just one New York Times drawing after another.
Oh, no, no, no. There's a lot here.
I mean, so let's just start with some of those not New York Times drawings.
What would you like to start with, David?
I want to start with the movies that he drew because he's still a year away from drawing any film for the New York Times. You know, he doesn't draw a film until 1965, Ship of Fools. But before that, they thought that films were moving pictures and that they saw it as a form of photography and they would use photographs.
Interesting.
Hirschfeld thought it was ridiculous. But he... You know,
that is a little silly because a lot of his first newspaper work were for films.
Of course.
But then eventually they're like, oh, no, no, no. We have to use the photographs.
Exactly. Exactly. He, you know, was one of the things that he said was insane, which was not necessarily a seal of approval there, but was he thought it was crazy.
Yeah.
Because it was crazy.
And they eventually came to their senses.
Yeah. So in 1964... Even though the heyday of the great studio era is over by this point, we've documented over 10 drawings that he did of films for four different studios. Wow.
That doesn't sound like a lot, but by this point, a lot of his film work has died off.
Yes.
And so 10 in one year is actually that is quite a few for 1964.
It is. When you consider that he's drawing every day, drawings took 3 or 4 days. And, you know, the time fills up. He did a lot of theater work this year. He did a lot of other things. But he does 10 film drawings for United Artists, for Universal, for MGM, and for Warner Brothers.
When do the UA movies start?
It's about 10 years earlier.
Oh, wow. Really? 54.
Yeah.
Okay.
But this is really starting to be the tail end.
I see.
But he does some great ones. I mean, one of the ones he does for United Artists is a film called Bedtime Story with Marlon Brando and David Niven.
I know David Niven. He was a panelist on What's My Line quite a few times, and he's pretty funny. That's the only thing I know about David Niven is he was a frequent panelist.
For those of you who don't know What's My Line or David Niven, he had a pretty substantial film career.
He was in Around the World in 80 Days.
Around the World in 80 Days.
Which Hirschfeld drew.
But he was the epitome of the suave, English-speaking leading man. I mean,
he
could be very funny, you know.
He is very funny. I do not see him as a leading man, but in my defense, I've only seen him on What's My Line. So I'll take your word for it.
Well, they shared the two leads, Marlon Brando and David Niven. And if you think, well, I've never heard of this movie, you probably heard of they made a remake of it, a film remake called Dirty Rotten Scoundrels.
I did not know this information. I'm going to be watching Bedtime Story very soon. I love Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. Hilarious movie, even better musical.
Right.
Continue.
And another film that he did for United Artists in 1964 was The Best Man. This is the Gore Vidal play from 1960, which he drew when it appeared on Broadway. It's a thinly veiled play, a drama about the 1960 presidential election.
Oh, interesting.
He was not a fan of the Kennedys.
Mm.
Don't hold it against Gore. So there's one character that is sort of an Adlai Stevenson, you know, honest, intellectual, maybe a little indecisive. And then there's the guy, the younger guy, who will do or say anything to get the job.
Interesting.
And the film is about the struggle. It's at a political convention. Mm. And the whole film is how they sort of are competing against each other and what they do. I don't want to have a spoiler alert on the podcast. But it's been revived a number of times on Broadway. Mm. In 2000 and 2012, it wouldn't necessarily get revived this year because we're not going to have a convention fight. Mm. This is when there's sort of a lot of interest in what's going to happen at the convention.
Yeah, and elections were a lot different 60 years ago.
Oh.
You didn't know who the nominee was going to be or even who was running until 4 months before or something.
As late as 1968.
Yeah, yeah.
At the Democratic Convention, they picked someone who was not even in the primaries.
Wow, yeah.
You know, yes, the smoke-filled rooms of a political convention, it's not the same these days.
Right, right.
In part because of that.
Mm.
But this film really captures, it is a political film, but it's much more than that. It's mm-hmm. human nature. It's mm. two different people trying to get to be the leader of something.
Right.
And he drew it. Hirschfeld drew it when it originally appeared on Broadway. He did the film for United Artists. And then 15 years later, he's drawing it again for the Movies to Remember series.
Right.
And the film starred Henry Fonda.
So that's the Movies to Remember with Henry Fonda.
One of the films to remember with Henry Fonda. He also gets the Oxbow incident.
Oh.
Melvin Douglas got a Tony for the role on Broadway.
Oh, wow.
And Lee Tracy, who played the outgoing president on Broadway, actually also played it in the film.
Oh, neat.
Yeah, so it was a fascinating sort of period piece, worth seeing. It's a good movie.
Mm.
Probably the best-known film that he drew in 1964, and this was for Warners, was My Fair Lady.
Of course. Who?
That was drawn, although that drawing would eventually appear in the New York Times. It was not drawn for the New York Times. It was drawn for Warners. It was sent to publications all over the country.
This is the print?
Yes, the print.
That drawing's from 64.
Yes.
I always thought that was done in the 90s.
No.
Interesting.
It was published as a print in the 90s.
Right, right.
But the drawing itself was done in 1964.
It's contemporaneous?
Yes.
Is that the word? Interesting. I learned something new today about very famous drawing that I probably should have known. Interesting. Okay. I did not realize that.
Another one he does for United Artists is a film called The Train.
Yes.
Which is about Germans taking a lot of French art and putting it on a train and then transporting it. And of course, the Allies, this is during World War II, of course,
right.
And the Allies trying to figure out how to stop the train without harming the contents.
Interesting.
Contemporary audiences would know the idea of the train film. In 2014, there was a film called Monuments Men, which starred George Clooney. And kind of was the same idea. It was the people who went after the art that the Nazis stole.
Is this a true event?
Yes.
Yeah. Or at least based on
exactly
a real thing that happened. Gotcha. I remember, the only thing I remember about this train drawing is I remember I was not working here very long, maybe 4 or 5 months.
Mm-hmm.
And so like there are these things sometimes in my beginning here that I thought were really important that turn out are not that important in the scheme of Hirschfeld. Like, I always thought 5 Miles to Midnight was, like, a really important drawing.
It's a great drawing.
It's a wonderful drawing, but in the scheme of things, it gets lost, you know.
Right.
But I remember having the train out on the table and looking. It's a big drawing. I think it's, like, a 30-22.
Yes.
Know? It was being purchased, and I remember how I just thought it was very important that someone wanted this drawing. I didn't know why they wanted this drawing, but I always thought it was a really important piece. Oh, that must be really important if somebody wants this, you know.
Well, it is. It's a great drawing.
It's much more of the drawing is not focused on a personality.
No.
It's much more of a feeling and a landscape.
It was drawn on location.
Yeah, yeah.
The
train is very central in the drawing. So it's kind of a different one in that it's, you know, not even a personality based.
But it has the train is central, but in front of the train are Burt Lancaster, the director, John Frankenheimer, and other actors, including Paul Scofield, actually. So, and that was something, you know, Hirschfeld would have been in Europe. It was a scene that he would have seen.
Oh, it was filmed in Europe.
It was filmed in Europe.
Oh, look at that. That's an interesting tidbit. How many on location film drawings are in another country?
Believe it or not, I think a significant number. Really? Because, and I don't think I'm telling tales out of school, but Hirschfeld, when he went to Europe in the summer, would often contact United Artists to see if there were any films being shot over there that he could visit, because if he visited them, then he could write off the trip as a business trip.
That's
and
right.
It would be a tax deduction.
That's right.
So we're getting into the finances of Al Hirschfeld. Yeah. Maybe too far afield of this podcast. The last thing I want to mention of the film drawings from this period, from this year, is there's a great drawing for United Artists that he does of all the stars of United Artists gathered around Harold Mersch, who was one of the founders and the heads of United Artists. And they all gathered around him to celebrate him, and they actually made a record. And this is on the cover of a record, tribute to Harold Mersch, Motion Picture Pioneer of the Year. And it's great. Shirley MacLaine, James Garner, Rex Harrison, all the people. I mean, Hirschfeld does a drawing of the Yellow Rolls Royce, which is this star-studded production. In which the drawing is a yellow Rolls Royce surrounded by all these big stars. That's also from 1964. But of course, he drew more than films in 1964. He did a great series for a magazine that you've probably never heard of outside of this building, which is Show Magazine.
I have heard of that.
Outside of this building?
No. No, it's actually, and so many of these old magazines are so large.
Yes.
And Show Magazine in particular feels
oversized.
Like 18 by 24. It's not that
big. It's
not
that big.
But it is a large magazine.
Well, you know, they were meant to be left on your coffee table.
Yeah, and maybe hang up some of the pages or.
I'm sure that's something you could do, but. Yeah. They were oversized magazines that really focused on the artwork.
Yeah.
You know, the layouts were terribly important. Mm-hmm. And they were monthly magazines. And it was, you left it out on your coffee table so everyone knew how hip you were.
That's true. So he did this series for a Show Magazine called Famous Feuds.
Yes.
Which, set it up for us.
Well, it's Famous Feuds was very similar to Kovarubis's Impossible Interviews. Hirschfeld would sort of pit people against each other, and then there would be commentary written by somebody else. And I mean, and Show Magazine, by the way, had all kinds of interesting articles. It's probably best known today for they hired an unknown woman to write an expose on the Playboy clubs, Hugh Hefner's Playboy clubs. And that young writer was Gloria Steinem. Mm. And that was the first time she was in the public consciousness, and she would go on to be such an important figure to the feminist movement in the 60s and 70s and 80s, and, you know, for her whole life. But there were some great Famous Feuds. In 1964, he pits the comedian Lenny Bruce against the police in a piece called Lenny and the Fuzz. He has Casey Stengel, the baseball manager, teaching English to Samuel Johnson, who was one of the great men of letters in England. And in fact, one of the Famous Feuds pieces is actually in the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Mm. In 1965, the Mona Lisa was brought to America.
Right.
And it was on display at the Met. At the same time, there was a retrospective of Rembrandt. Mm. And the question was, who are more people going to see?
Oh, I think I know and, the answer to that.
Well, Hirschfeld's drawing was a full-color painting of, there's a very famous painting of Aristotle contemplating the bust of Homer. Mm. And here he's got Aristotle there contemplating the Mona Lisa, and he's pouring poison into a glass that she has. You know, and the Metropolitan Museum of Art bought it for $250.
Mm, I think, didn't the Mona Lisa come in 63?
Oh, maybe it did.
Because I thought Jackie Kennedy was
right.
Was important in that something.
You were
or
right.
Or she claims she was important.
Also in 1964 was the first drawing he did of the Beatles.
Right.
In a feud with the Singing Nun.
Big year.
Over who would be the top of the charts.
Dare I say, the rest of these famous feuds are a little dated. I've never heard of Samuel Johnson or Casey Stengel. I've heard the name Lenny Bruce.
Wow.
But I think these are a little, I think they would have been a big hit at the time.
Yes. They were very much key to what was happening at the time. So there was one, for instance, of Ilya Kazan and Lee Strasberg, who were sort of battling over who was going to run the theater at the new Performing Arts Center built on the west side of Manhattan called Lincoln Center.
You ever heard of it?
So today we look at those and people would say, what are they talking about?
Right, why are they feuding? What's the feud?
Right.
Ilya Kazan and Lee Strasberg, why are they feuding? But at the time, you would know exactly what was happening.
Right. And what's different is this is real topical satire that Hirschfeld was producing that hasn't aged well. You know, when we look at Daumier's work, he is commenting on things that were happening at that time that no longer are important.
Right, right.
What he was talking about, we lose, but we appreciate the artistic nature of it.
This makes me think of the doodles.
The photo doodles?
Yes, yes. Where I think those have stood the test of time.
Well, yes, because that's on a basic identification situation.
Mm,
you know,
it's not situational.
Well, yes. So Jimmy Durante is compared to Al Smith there. Mm-hmm. Do you know who Al Smith is?
Well, no, I don't. No. But I was thinking Mary Pickford and Hitler.
Sure.
Oliver Harold Hardy Ross and Stalin,
sure.
Oliver Hardy and who did he turn?
Gandhi.
Oh, Gandhi, that's right.
But for 1937, Al Smith would have been talking about like George Pataki.
I see.
If you were
you're right. Closer. This is the famous feuds are much more situational based.
Right.
Yeah.
And very topical in nature.
And
of course, what year in Hirschfeld's career would be complete without some drawings for S.J. Proman.
That's right.
And it's a sign of the times that the drawings that he's doing for Proman are not for Collier's or Red Book or Saturday Evening Post. They're for TV Guide.
Wow, both of them.
Yeah.
Wow.
It was for an article called Be a Television Writer, Earn No Money.
That probably holds true today.
Yes.
As well.
I think they just had a strike over it.
That did age well.
But there's a great drawing of Proman with Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton, who in 1964...
They were
at the height of their relationship and public awareness of it. And, the piece is, I yielded to Elizabeth's entreaties and dined with her. But the caption on Hirschfeld's drawing said, I found our conversation inhibited by the presence of a Welsh loafer named Barton or Benton.
I see. I didn't get that until just now.
he's making
fun. Talking about Richard Burton.
Right, of course.
I missed that part. I see.
And to Welsh. Audiences then, everybody knew who Richard Burton
was.
Yes. I mean, Hirschfeld talks about, how people would say, how comes when you draw Richard Burton, it doesn't look like the Richard Burton I see?
Mm.
Because they're all, people were in love with the guy. He was literally the great example of leading man, Shakespeare actor. He was every woman's dream and every man was envious of him.
Yeah.
And so Hirschfeld drawing him, he made him look like he was a normal person.
Mm. I see Richard Burton in drawings that are not Richard Burton.
Yes.
You go to the Walter Kerr Theater.
That is not Richard Burton at the back of the theater.
Oh, man. That's one that'll go down in history for sure.
We were there one night, just so you know, listeners. And I was there with Catherine. And she
comes... Walter Kerr Theater.
The Walter Kerr Theater. And after the performance, we were there for a little talk back with some of the cast. And she turns to me, she says, why do they have a picture of Richard Burton?
A drawing. No, that's the original. I knew it was an original drawing.
Why do they have a drawing, a Hirschfeld drawing of Richard Burton at the back of the theater? And I said, what are you talking about? She says, oh, no, he's there in the back of the theater. And I look, and it's a drawing of Walter Kerr at a typewriter. And I can tell you this, Walter Kerr would have been super
impressed
and feel great about themselves. maybe his wife saw him that way. Yeah. But I don't think that many other people mistake the two.
In my defense, I think it looks strikingly similar to Richard Burton. So,
but of course, 1964, the most significant work that he would do in 1964 was on the American theater.
And we've got some big hits.
Would say some of the most iconic works by Hirschfeld were drawn
David,
in this year.
Let's just start with the first drawing of 1964.
First drawing of the year. You mean first Alec Guinness and Dylan?
That's not the one I was thinking.
It was in a diptych with another show.
You may have heard of it. You may have seen this drawing before. It's Carol Channing and Hello, Dolly.
Original production. First drawing, Sunday before it
opened
on Broadway.
The one you're thinking of.
Yeah.
The Hirschfeld drawing you're thinking of. That was the first theater drawing in the New York Times for 1964.
Yes.
Great and, trivia question.
And while Alec Guinness won a Tony for his performances, the poet Dylan Thomas, of course, Carol Channing is the one who made a legend.
Of course.
And other classics from 1964, Funny Girl with Barbara Streisand, not the one with the roller skate rag. This is
the one. Well, because that's from the film.
Exactly. But this is the one where she's looking into the mirror and it's a photograph of Fanny Bryce.
That is one of my husband's favorite Hirschfeld drawings.
Really?
I don't know why, but he always says the one where Barbara Streisand's looking at the photograph. Mm. That's the one he likes. I don't know.
And, of course, the other really great drawing, iconic drawing from this year, is the original cast drawing of Fiddler on the Roof.
Oh, of course. Oh, that old thing. Yes.
The Funny Girl wasn't made into a print. The film version was. Mm-hmm. But all three of those pieces are known so well because they were made into prints and because they are better than anything else in summing up those shows.
Yeah, and we also have Josephine Baker.
Oh, Josephine Baker.
The 64 Josephine Baker, which was also made into a print. That's a wonderful drawing.
Yeah. And, you know, we recently posted it on Facebook. Mm. You know, Doug Koons, our media director, is always putting up the drawing of the day, you know, from this date. And so it was this date and it was, I think it was like February 64. So, of course, it goes up at the beginning of the month. And and it's her with all these feathers and sequins. Someone writes, I never saw Josephine Baker with all these feathers. Mm-hmm. Doug did the simplest of Google searches and found tons of photos.
That look exactly like this drawing.
So if you're going to comment on Facebook, Google it first.
Check yourself before you wreck yourself. Because, Well, I think people, for good reason, maybe think of the bananas. You know, when they think of Josephine Baker.
Yeah.
But by 1964, she's an older woman.
No.
She's probably not dancing around in just bananas anymore. So you see all the... And that was so big at the time. Does she not look just like Carol Channing in Hello, Dolly?
Yes.
With all the feathers and all the, you know, huge costumes. So very much of the time. And yes, we will find... We will find photographic evidence that shows Hirschfeld is not lying.
Yeah, he didn't make it up, folks.
Don't try with us.
It's a visual archive, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
he's
absolutely
not making these things up.
No.
But we talked about Lincoln Center. So 1964, Lincoln Center was a big deal because here they had taken part of a neighborhood and they were creating this sort of never really before done performing arts center. In 1943, City Center created the first performing arts center in America. We did a whole episode on it, so you should look that up. They were the ones who showed that there was an audience that wanted to come to a building to see music, to see dance, to see theater, films sometimes. You know, there was a place that people wanted to go and that would go. And so the success of City Center was they were sort of bursting at the seams. And originally Lincoln Center was sort of going to be built as sort of a bigger version of City Center, but City Center would run it.
I see.
And then in a very last minute cloak and dagger situation. Mm. City Center was taken away from being the producer. Oh.
And this is where Ilya Kazan and Lee Strasberg come
in. Yeah, I think that's one of the other battles that were going on.
Yeah.
But like, for instance, the New York City Ballet, before it went to Lincoln Center, was the New York City Center Ballet.
Interesting.
And what is also interesting is, as I said in the episode on City Center, the idea of the revival of Broadway musicals really did not exist before City Center. Mm. They wanted to start presenting theater, Broadway producers, and they wanted to present it for cheaply so anybody could come. And Broadway producers were nervous that if they were presenting high-grade theater for low prices, who was going to come to Broadway? So City Center agreed to not do any new shows. They would only do revivals. And there really, nobody was doing revivals at that time.
When I asked you, you know, when did the revival start? You said like 54?
They start about 10 years earlier. City Center starts with a production of New Moon, and then they do Carmen Jones, which was a huge hit for them.
Shocked, even just when I thought it was 1954 they were doing revivals. That's so early.
Well, Gene Dalrymple, who ran the theater program at City Center and did so much else for City Center, thought there would be an audience for the Rodgers and Hammerstein musicals that we all now sort of revere as classics. But then they were just the shows that this songwriting team did. And it was the revivals at City Center that helped create them as classics.
Yeah, I was going to say that. Yeah.
And in 1964, there's a real break because who is hired to do the musical theater productions at Lincoln Center but Richard Rodgers?
That seems like an unfair advantage.
Yes.
A little bit. Little bit.
And... of course, what does he do? He wants to do shows that he knows. So they do a revival of The King and I. Mm. Yeah. And before that, there had been a great revival of The King and I at City Center just a couple years before. And Gene Dalrymple recognized that Rodgers was literally taking the best shows that they had done and now making them unavailable. You know, they had shown that revivals could produce business, and now the revivals that they were doing, they couldn't do anymore because Rodgers wasn't going to license it to them do it for a bigger theater at Lincoln Center. Mm. But he also did The Merry Widow, which was, you know, an operetta. I don't think anybody would do it today, but in 1964, there was still a big audience for that type of operetta. But it also in 1964, Hirschfeld draws the City Center production of Porgy and Bess. Mm. And I think arguably this is his best drawing of the musical. I just really love it.
We also have Donald Pleasence in Porbitos. I will shout out our new American Theater book, Volume 2, 1962 to 2002. But I call this drawing out because it's actually in the color section. It's a black and white drawing. It's in the color section of our American Theater book because you can see it as an original drawing. You can actually see it as an artifact.
Right.
So what Hirschfeld drew, I think there might be some New York Times stamps on it.
Sure.
You know, lots of kind of, you can see where they do the corners to where they want to crop it for to run it
the
in
crop
the
marks.
Yep, the crop marks to run in the newspaper. So it's really interesting. And we picked this, I mean, we had quite a few to choose from. But we picked this one because we thought it had a lot of that kind of extra stuff that you don't know are on the original drawings.
The sort of artifacts of its history, in a way.
Yes.
You know, these were not, he didn't finish these drawings and put them into a frame and they hung on a wall.
Right, and they're perfectly white and, there's no extra marks on them or anything. No, they're actually kind of dirty a lot of times.
Yeah,
they've got a lot of stuff on them and...
I mean, he's still sometimes putting on blue washes.
Yeah.
Where these Bende dot patterns would be used. And so sometimes it's blue, these blue washes, and there's a number like 905.
Yep.
Which to an uninitiated person would be like, why is that? Well, 905 was the screen number that they wanted to use for that. You have this sort of interesting period in New York theater. And the implications also for the rest of the country are these revivals. So he drew some very interesting revivals at this time. I want to point out two revivals that don't have anything to do with either Lincoln Center or City Center, but they turned out to be very sort of landmark productions, and they're Shakespeare revivals. There's a King Lear with Paul Scofield and Irene Worth. This is Peter Brook's landmark production with Scofield in the title role. He did it for the Royal Shakespeare Theater in November of 1962. And then it went on a world tour that eventually brought it to Broadway in 1964. Mm. It was eventually adapted into a film in 1971. The reason they brought it to Broadway in 1964 is because it was part of Shakespeare's 400th anniversary celebration. It was the 400th anniversary of his birth.
Oh.
And in a 2004 poll, Royal Shakespeare Company actors voted this as the finest performance ever on a Royal Shakespeare Company stage.
Wow.
So I think that is a testament. The original drawing, I can tell you, is in the collection of Harvard.
Mm.
They understood that it was a very important work.
They always have good taste.
Yeah. Shout out to Mel Seton.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, a month later, the next drawing he does for the Times is 1 month later, and it's also of a Shakespeare production. This one is of Hamlet.
That's my favorite Shakespeare.
That's your favorite Shakespeare?
Yes. Ooh. What's your favorite Shakespeare?
Wow, I have a couple of them. I do like Midsummer Night's Dream.
Oh, yes, that's a David Leopold.
Yeah. So, I mean, I like the comedies, Merry Wives of Windsor, mm-hmm. I'm a big fan of. But then you really can't go wrong with Julius Caesar or Macbeth.
Mm. True. Of course, I like the Kenneth Branagh Hamlet. We don't have to talk about that today. We can do a special podcast for that.
For those of you... You should have a podcast where you talk about your favorite films and TV shows. Because she doesn't like them. She loves them.
I love them.
And she can tell you things about these films, not based on any type of real information.
All right, tell us about the 64 Hamlet, though.
Well, the 64 Hamlet is very interesting. The lead was played by Alfred Ryder, who was a very intense, ambitious actor. And he wanted to, you know, starting in the 40s, he talked about being the definitive Hamlet of his generation.
Oh.
And in 1964, Joe Papp hires the 48-year-old Ryder to play Hamlet, to realize his dream.
Okay.
And
wait, he had never played Hamlet before?
Never played Hamlet before.
I thought he was like taking his act around the country, like, I'm going to be the definitive Hamlet. He's never even done it. Okay.
I don't know if he had never done it. He'd never done it in New York and never done it on Broadway.
That's enough for me. Okay.
The crazy thing is, there was a production of Hamlet on Broadway that season, and it was Richard Burton.
Oh.
So... I don't know what Joe Papp... I mean, Joe Papp was thinking, I'm sure this had to do with his thinking, I'm going to bring Hamlet to the people that they can see for free in Central Park.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
But Ryder gets laryngitis the night of the premiere. And while he... Which was broadcast on CBS.
Wow.
Okay. Like... You couldn't ask for a better situation. Alfred Ryder had the opportunity to be the great American Shakespearean actor. And Murphy's Law. He starts to lose his voice.
Oh, no.
And, I mean, there were other... Stacey Keach, the actor Stacey Keach, was in the production. And he talks about Ryder's erratic performance... And difficult remembering, you know, he had this difficulty remembering lines even in rehearsals. But he wrote it off the fact that Ryder was a drunk.
Was this guy an actor?
Yeah.
He's trying to be the best Hamlet and he can't even memorize his lines?
So Joe Papp replaces him after the opening night.
Oh, wow. Joe Papp
with,
as Hamlet?
With
Oh, no. Richard Burton. I thought you were saying Joe Papp. Plays him.
No,
he replaced. I was like, well, this is crazy.
Joe Papp did many incredible things for the theater, but he never played Hamlet.
Yeah, okay, gotcha. That's why I was like, okay. So Joe Papp replaces Alfred Ryder with
Richard Burton's understudy in Hamlet, because here's a guy who knows all the work, and
he's already
you can put it right it in.
Absolutely.
Ryder gets better. And
no, dude,
Joe Papp won't let him come back into the production.
No.
Lee Grant, who was in the production, said it ruined Ryder's career.
Yeah, well,
you know, it because everybody
knew. Especially
if it was
broadcast. Yeah. Oh gosh.
So
we also get Julie Harris in this drawing. I always like to point out Julie Harris.
And I love this drawing because it shows you not only see the production, but you see the New York skyline in the background.
Yeah, you can see it was an outdoor, or at least, you know, if you know, I think it shows it was an outdoor production in Central Park.
Exactly. So it's a real, I think it's a real piece of history, yeah, as it were. And then I think one of the last drawings I want to talk about is Bajor with the late, great Cheetah Rivera. Based on a Joseph Mitchell story. Joseph Mitchell, for all of those.
I know this.
Who is Joseph Mitchell?
Up in the Old Hotel.
Oh, yeah. Great book. A collection of his pieces, mostly profiles he wrote for The New Yorker, that included his very famous profile of...
Mr. Drogul.
Yes, indeed.
Yes. Is it Professor Siegel?
Professor Siegel, 1942, yeah. And then... Joe Gould's Secret.
Are they both in Up in the Old Hotel?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I thought
Well,
it was Joe
Gould's Secret is the last thing that Mitchell would publish.
I see. Right.
Even though he would continue to go into the offices of The New Yorker every day to write for the next 30 years.
Joseph Mitchell. Wow.
He was a friend of Hirschfeld's. Mm. And the Bajor was a musical based on Mitchell's stories about the gypsies in New York. Mm. And Bajor was allegedly a Romany word for a con game in which lonely and unhappy women are swindled out of their life savings.
This sounds like today it would just be a text message scam, maybe, or an email scam.
Well, they had to do it. They had to work with what they had.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's an Edward Albee play, Tiny Alice, that's part of this season. There's another Julie Harris drawing, actually.
Yes.
Ready When You Are, CB. And I had always known that play title. And I kind of knew what the play was about, and I couldn't understand what that referred to.
Yeah.
But... this is what I love about research. Mm-hmm. I looked up, and Ready When You Are, CB is based on an apocryphal story of DeMille, Cecil B. DeMille, filming an extravagant scene in which an entire town is going to be destroyed. Mm. And he set up three cameras, and the scene played, the town was destroyed. And picking up his megaphone, the director asked, "Camera one, how was it?" And they replied, "Real work of art, CB, but the film broke."
Oh, no.
And then DeMille goes to the second camera and says, "Camera two, how'd it go?" And he says, "Brilliant, CB, but I left the lens cap on."
Oh, no.
Now desperate, DeMille calls out, "Camera three, come in, camera three." And the punchline is, "Ready when you are, CB."
Oh, no. That's hilarious. That's great.
That's making me feel better because for years I wondered what that was about.
That is very funny.
So finally, he does one more piece of theatrical work, not for the New York Times, but for that theater standby, that thing you get every time you go to a Broadway show, is a playbill. He started a monthly series in Playbill called Unlikely Casting.
And it's exactly as it sounds.
Yes.
Where he would cast, I guess, mostly actors, but other people from the theater community.
Yes.
In their most unlikely roles. I think probably the one that will kind of cue you in on what this is Zero Mostel. Imagine Zero Mostel, okay?
Yeah.
Now imagine him as Peter Pan.
Oh, it's a great drawing.
Right? Yeah, that is a great one.
Burt Lars, King Lear.
That's a good one.
Later this year, we're doing a Noel Coward online exhibition. And in that exhibition was going to be an unlikely casting piece of Ethel Merman and Ernest Borgnine in Private Lives.
Mm.
And that has a little bit more topical nature today. Audiences wouldn't know.
This is a little bit more Famous Feuds lane.
Yes.
Yes.
Because they were two really... intense characters, I would say. And somehow they meet and decide to get married, and it lasts all of 38 days.
Oh, wow. Wow.
The other one I really like from this series and happened in 1964 is Sammy Davis and Robert Preston in Boys from Syracuse, where their faces are sort of overlaid on each other. And whenever they did the unlikely casting, they would have either somebody from the drawing or in the one from Private Lives, they had Noel Coward write a caption. And the one from the Boys from Syracuse, they have Sammy Davis saying, "The idea of playing twin brothers is far-fetched for two reasons. He's older and he's taller."
Yes. That's funny.
And of course, what he did do, there was a very, again, a very topical one in 1964. It was unlikely casting. It was Barry Goldwater and Lyndon Johnson in Waiting for Godot, because they were running for president that year.
That's good.
And there's also a famous one in this series. In December, he did David Merrick as Santa Claus,
right,
hoping to really put a finger in the eye of David Merrick.
Well, David Merrick was a producer.
Oh, producer.
A Broadway producer who was
Hello, Dolly.
Famously not a very nice person.
He was called the Abominable Showman.
He's a Colonel Tom Parker type.
Oh, yeah.
He's a money guy. He's not a nice character.
Nevertheless, he produced a tremendous number of...
There are plenty of great leaders like that.
Great theater.
Right, right. I mean, like he was good at that, but yes. As a social person, maybe not so much, right?
Yes, as a human being, he
was... not so great.
He got bad reviews, so let's just put it that way. Yeah.
So Hirschfeld does this unlikely casting of David Merrick, and Hirschfeld knows he's also, I guess, not a big fan of David Merrick.
He freely admitted that he was not a big fan.
So he does, it's David Merrick as Santa Claus, but it's Santa Claus, like, in a la Grinch.
Yes, stealing all the gifts.
Stealing the gifts and on his tippy, on his really tippy toes and everything like that.
Bell booking candle, the whole nine yards.
Yes.
And he had an exhibition of his work right around this time, probably at the Hammer Galleries. And Hirschfeld wanted Merrick to know how he felt, so he put the drawing in the window.
Oh.
You know, like, screw you, David Merrick. Merrick sees it. I mean, he was right. Merrick saw it, buys the work, and then that year for his Christmas card, reproduces it and adds a Christmas tree that has been knocked over and is on fire.
That is awesome. I wish we had one of those Christmas cards.
Oh, you can find it.
Oh, you think? You think we can find it?
You can find the image.
Oh, really?
Oh,
I'll have to look that up.
Classic.
I've never seen that with the Christmas tree added. That's funny.
And that's when Hirschfeld realized you can't insult anybody.
And that's what I mean. Even when Hirschfeld is trying to insult someone, he's not trying to, he did. And the guy's like, oh, I love this. This is great.
Yeah. You
know, he really got me.
It's true. It's true. So that all happens in one year.
Wow.
60 years ago. He does other drawings.
I wanted to call it another unlikely casting.
Oh, sure.
Carol Channing as Lady Macbeth.
Yes.
Which would be quite something to see. Maybe she could pull it off. I don't know. I would go see it. Maybe Broadway needs to think about this a little bit.
She wanted, I think, do it on roller skates.
Oh, that would be funny. Is that what her caption
said?
Yeah,
caption. But there was a great one of...
Carol Channing as Lady Macbeth on roller skates.
Another theatrical production that he draws, not for the times, Carol Burnett had already had her breakout role on Broadway in Once Upon a Mattress. But then Julie Stein in Comden and Green write Fade Out, Fade In for her. And the producers come and ask Hirschfeld to do the poster. He does a drawing for the poster in which it gets printed as a poster. But I don't know exactly who says it, whether it's Carol Burnett or somebody else. But it's not a great drawing of Carol Burnett. It doesn't have that sort of, that look of Carol Burnett that we all know and love.
Yeah.
And he is asked to do another drawing, which he does, which is, to me, is classic Carol Burnett.
Yeah.
And we have both of those posters in the American Theater as seen by Hirschfeld.
Yes, and they're in the color section.
Yeah. Yes,
that was a color poster. Was Carol Burnett the person he also had trouble drawing later in her life?
Yeah.
Am I right? Yeah.
Yeah. So she had some cosmetic surgery.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1995, she came back to Broadway in Ken Ludwig's Moon Over Buffalo. Mm. And Hirschfeld had gone out of town to do the drawing. And it appeared in the paper. And I have to admit, it didn't strike me as Carol Burnett. Mm. And this is the year after Dolly died. Mm. And he was sort of a single man about town. Mm-hmm. And he's out one night with Frank Rich and his wife, Alex Witchell. And they get to talking about Moon Over Buffalo or something. And Hirschfeld says, you know, she's a lot harder to draw now since she's had this plastic surgery.
Right.
There's no character left. He did not, he was not saying this for publication.
Of course not.
In fact, I know, that he thought this was just a comment between friends.
Right.
Alex Witchell puts it in the newspaper. Mm. And Hirschfeld is mortified.
I'm sure.
I mean, the last thing he wants to do is insult a performer.
And he wasn't. He was kind of just stating, he was telling it like it is.
Right.
Saying, look, it's, I mean, we all can, I mean, I think Priscilla Presley is the first who comes to my mind. I have not seen her expression change in, I don't know, 20 years, you know? If you get a lot of work done, you get stuck that way.
Right.
And so he was just merely stating a fact. You know, it wasn't even like commentary on it. He was just saying, you know, she's a lot harder to draw now.
But if you were going to see Priscilla Presley, you wouldn't go out in public and say, haven't seen her expression change in 20 years.
No.
That would be rude.
That's true.
So that's what he would, because it's not that Hirschfeld was great friends who saw with Carol Burnett and saw her all the time, but she was in the theater community.
Of course.
And, you know, Hirschfeld had known her for years. And sure enough, at a party, probably a week or two after this, he sees her. And Carol Burnett, who's such a trooper and such a great person, comes over to Al and hugs him.
Oh.
You know, to just say it's all right.
Don't worry about it.
You know. And of course, he felt bad about it.
Yeah.
He apologized and she let it roll right off her
good,
back. She
good.
Was pleased to be drawn by Hirschfeld.
Excellent.
But it's funny that would be something that Hirschfeld would catch.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he doesn't just do it would have been easy for him to draw Carol Burnett as he had always drawn Carol Burnett.
Sure, right.
And that's not the woman who was on stage.
Right, right. That makes sense. When you said he saw Carol Burnett, I was going to say in the window and couldn't resist it.
1964 also has the distinction of being the first year he does ads for the El San Juan Hotel.
Oh, the El San Juan Hotel ads.
In Puerto Rico.
Yes.
They have these wonderful composites of a lot of unlikely characters who would be together.
I know. Okay, Sammy Davis Jr., Lena Horne?
No, Liza Minnelli.
Lena Horne's not in them?
No, Lena's not. She never played. Oh, she may have played there, but she wasn't in the ads. Milton Berle, B.B. King, Frankie Avalon. There were all kinds of like sort of mid-60s stars.
Yeah.
And they would continue for 8 or 9 years.
Wow.
And in fact, because it was a big hotel in Puerto Rico. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's why they got all this top talent.
Right.
And of course, as things do, it's cyclical. It went into sort of eclipse for a while. And then a couple of years ago, we were contacted by the hotel. They were renovating it. And they had wanted to put up large reproductions of these ads.
Yeah.
And so we licensed them. There's like 5 or 6 of them on the walls.
Yeah.
So if you go to the El San Juan in Puerto Rico, look for the Hirschfelds.
Wow, what a year. What a year it's been here in 1964.
Indeed. I think probably any year you could look at Hirschfeld and find all kinds of fascinating things.
Oh, definitely.
But if you go to the website and go under timelines,
right,
you literally can look at any drawing. You know, any drawings he did in any given year. And we usually have a handful of things that happened to him that year.
Right. But 64 does have quite a few heavy hitters. From Fiddler on the Roof to Hello, Dolly to the Unlikely Castings. I mean, we got some big ones.
In theater, we're still seeing a lot of these plays
on
Broadway.
Yes, that's true. Yep.
I mean, we didn't even talk about the first Sondheim musical, you know, on his own, Anyone Can Whistle.
Wow.
So we'll have to save that for some future episode.
Have we done a Sondheim episode?
We have not.
No, we haven't.
Watch out, folks.
I don't want to say it out loud, but I'm not a big Sondheim fan.
You just said it out loud.
I don't know. I don't.
We
know
now have tape of it, so we can use it against you.
Well, maybe we should do a Sondheim episode sometime soon.
I think we should get a Sondheim person.
That's what I mean. I'm not well-versed in Sondheim. I can do an Andrew Lloyd Webber episode. No problem. I don't know.
I'll step back and let you. But for 60 years ago today, it doesn't seem that long because so many of these shows are still part and parcel of the shows that we see, whether on Broadway or in theaters around the country.
Yes. If we were in 1934, yeah, it would be a little bit different.
A lot less. A
lot less.
And I would even say 1974, won't get it. Yeah, 1964 probably. Was a very, very fertile year.
Yeah, 60s are good for theater, I feel like. Well, thank you so much for joining us on this great tour of American entertainment. And actually, we were in Europe. We were in Europe also.
Yes.
So world entertainment and Puerto Rico. Yes.
Yes.
So world entertainment in 1964 covered a lot. I hope you enjoyed this. I thought there were some pretty good stories. I learned something. At least one thing, maybe even two or three.
She's reached her quota for the week then.
That's right. I don't. It's only Monday. Oh, thank God I don't do anything else the rest of the week. All right.
But as I said, we post some of these drawings every day.
Yep.
Not necessarily ones from 64, but follow us.
That would be wild if we were like, every day we have to post a drawing from 1964.
It would not work
because we would eventually
there are not that enough drawings from 1964. But you can find out, if you want to see the drawings or the birthdays, Doug does an incredible birthday post every day, and you will be shocked at when you see how many people's, what people share birthdays, and you see these great drawings. Yeah. You know, he gives you sort of headshots of everybody whose birthday it is. And you can find us on Facebook. On Twitter.
Twitter and Instagram, Al Hirschfeld. Facebook, Al Hirschfeld Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
YouTube, Al Hirschfeld Foundation. And our podcast, of course, now on all platforms for podcasts. Obviously, you found it somehow. The Hirschfeld Century Podcast. Leave us a review. If you've left us a review on Apple, but now you listen on Spotify because that's cooler, leave us a review on Spotify too so other people can find us. We would appreciate that.
We would appreciate it. And Catherine will really, it sets her up.
Yep.
You'd be making her day.
Ready to go.
You can find some of the works we discussed today on HirschfeldHomestyle.com.
Yes, I'm looking at the Peter Falk pillow I have. Right now, it's right behind David. It looks so good.
Yeah.
And that Peter Falk image, oh, is that 64?
No.
No, that would have been
great.
That's
about 10 years later.
Okay, that's, oh yeah, it's 70s. But that Peter Falk image, one of our top sellers.
Yes.
If not the top seller. Yeah. I don't know what has sold more than Peter Falk, to be honest. But yeah, Hirschfeld Homestyle, we've got a lot of great images and products for your home. You can decorate.
Oh, yeah. Or you need an iPhone case going to the beach and need a towel.
Yeah.
They can all be Hirschfeld.
And then, of course, we do have our Al Hirschfeld Foundation shop.org where you can find hand-signed limited edition prints and lots of different apparel, tote bags, things like that as well.
I think we've got Fiddler tote bags. And
we do have Fiddler tote bags.
And Hello Dolly t-shirts.
Merch. Yep, yeah, Hello Dolly. So. We have the etching as well on our store.
So thank you very much for listening, and we will see you when we do.
Bye.